The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the author of The Burgess Boys, Elizabeth Strout. She's got a fantastic book now out in paperback, of course, a New York Times bestseller here. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell me, who are the Burgess Boys?
The Burgess Boys are two brothers that are grown in this book. They're adults, and the older brother, Jim, is a very successful, was famous lawyer, and his younger brother, Bob, is a legal aid attorney, and they are very different in personality, and they're very, very entwined with each other. There was an accident that occurred when they were kids, and so they're quite caught up with each other, even as adults. A fraught relationship, shall I say.
Of course, Bob, he's a twin.
He is a twin to his sister, Susan, who has stayed in Maine. The Burgess brothers are both living in New York. They sort of ran away from this town as soon as they could. And their sister, Bob's sister, twin sister, stayed up there in Maine. And the boys came down to New York, yeah.
Jim, very successful. Bob kind of looks up to his brother. How about Jim? What does he think of Bob?
Oh, Jim constantly puts Bob down. Constantly puts Bob down. And then hopefully by the time the book is, you know, done, the reader understands why that's been happening. But that's the nature of their relationship, or has been the nature of their relationship for quite some time. And it will change during the course of the book. But Jim is not very respectful of him.
Where are we at in Maine with this book, where Sandy lives?
Where Susan lives, his sister. Yeah. Shirley Falls is one of those towns that you find anywhere, really, in this country, but because it is Maine, I'll speak specifically to that. But it used to be a textile town. You know, there were mills and many people that worked in them, and it was sort of a thriving community. And, of course, for the last 30 or 40 years, those mills have been closed. And so now it's a very a town with a great deal of poverty and unemployment. And also the home now to a group of 2,000 or 3,000 Somali refugees, which, of course, for the state of Maine is quite a transition for them to have to make, because Maine is the whitest state, has traditionally been the whitest state of the 50.
So we're looking at a real town in Maine?
Well, it is based on, loosely based on Lewiston, Maine, where a Somali population did come. I think they began in 1998, and there were problems. The mayor asked them to leave, and there was an incident that I did use from real life. The only time I've ever used something from the news or real life, where, in fact, a young man did so horribly throw a pig's head through a mosque. Storefront mosque. And I did use that. I fictionalized the perpetrator of the crime. I made him quite a bit younger and much more unconscious, you know, not really understanding what he did, not understanding the full impact of what he did. Because as a novelist, I thought that was more fitting to sort of the human condition. Most of us are pretty unconscious about what we do. And we just don't really understand how deeply we might have hurt somebody else or some community. Yeah.
And thus, Bob goes and he sees his twin sister, who he hasn't seen probably in 5 years
or
so.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
When he left for New York, he left a lot of ghosts in Maine, I guess.
Huh? Sure did. Just like many people, I think Bob felt that, you know, the city was where you could run to and leave your past behind. I think that's still kind of an American dream in many ways. You know, we are, I think, still a country where we believe we can reinvent ourselves. And honestly, we can in many ways. Of course, we take ourselves wherever we go. It's kind of a little thing we forget, but we do.
Yeah, I was wondering if each city, though, seems just like the next city, or, you know, how that works to reinvent yourself, I guess. You can become pretty successful if you do that.
You know, it depends. I mean, all these things are a combination of, you know, where you live originally, where what your place is of origin and what your desires are. And Bob's desire was mostly just to follow Jim wherever he went, because Jim was like the father. They lost their father at a very young age, and so Jim was like the man of the family, and Bob just adores him and sort of needed to be where Bob was. And we see that sometimes, I think, with when there's been a vacuum filled by a sibling or somebody else. And so basically Bob has also followed Jim. You know, that was the reason, one of the reasons that he went to New York, because Jim, his big brother went.
And Jim, he's pretty famous in Maine also, and people yes. see him on television a lot.
Yeah.
What does that do to Bob while he's in Maine?
You know, Bob is, well, you know, I mean, I wrote him, so maybe maybe I have a different point of view, but I think Bob is so eternally open-hearted in a certain way, and just in his open-heartedness is just so proud of his brother and doesn't resent him, really. I mean, I think there are wisps of envy that he recognizes in himself at times, but mostly he's just so proud of his brother. And, you know, his brother went to Harvard Law School, which was quite a big deal for, you know, they came from a very working-class background and were lucky to go to the state university at all. And then Jim went from there to Harvard. And Bob thinks he's just pretty wonderful.
Elizabeth, are you a twin at all?
I'm not.
No. Well, these twins don't seem to get along very good.
No, they don't. And I've always been interested in twins. You know, who knows why? I'm interested in a lot of things. And from my completely unscientific vantage point, it seems to me that twins are either very close or they're not. There doesn't seem to be a lot of in-between kind of stuff, like you might find with other siblings.
It seems like both of them not quite the success that they could be, considering Jim, the big-time lawyer.
Right. I think both of them are divorced. Jim is not. They've both had the misfortune of having that occur in their lives. And, of course, you don't plan that. Nobody decides to live a life that includes a divorce, I think. And yet this has occurred to both of them. Bob, being who he is still very good friends with his ex-wife. Because she wants to be, and he's Bob, and he'll be. Susan is not. Susan has had, I think, some harder knocks than Bob.
When you were writing the Burgess Boys, take me through that experience. I mean, you probably visited the town that this is based on, or maybe you were born there or lived there.
Well, I certainly am very familiar with the town. My grandparents were from there. I used to live with my grandmother in a town nearby at times during my childhood, and then I went to college in this town. So it's a town that I'm very familiar with. I would go back a lot as I wrote it, but the largest task that I had in writing this book was to acquaint myself with the Somali culture and the Somali community as much as I could, because the biggest decision I had was whether or not in this book I would take on the point of view of some Somali characters. And I thought if I did not, then they would just remain the other. And for anybody reading the book, they would just remain what they are in so many communities, which is the other. And I thought, I can't do that. So that was a little intimidating to me. So for about 7 years, I was quite obsessed with learning about the Somali community and the culture and their history and everything I could learn.
Bob, he's kind of amazed, too. I mean, he'll point out to his sister, is that one?
Yeah, even though he's lived in New York, which is much more multicultural, when he goes back to a town that he grew up in where there were not dark-skinned Muslim people walking around, you know, even Bob finds himself thinking, oh, my, look, that's, you know, that's different, and it is. So people have stuff to get used to, and that's the way it is in this country now, and I personally think this is all a good thing. Eventually, we'll all be better for it.
One part in the story that I thought was a little different than it made me smile was when they go in, maybe to get their teeth fixed, maybe their hair fixed, they want to barter the price.
That's right. It's just a cultural difference. It's just how that culture has worked, which for, you know, the hosting culture, the white Americans, they're like, well, this is so rude. We've never seen anything like this. We have set prices. But they don't. They didn't in Somalia. It's just, that's just how it's done. So that's just one example of the adjustments that both sides have to make.
I guess if I were an innkeep or a storekeep, I would probably tell them the prices were higher than make them feel like they got a better price than by bringing it down. Huh?
I don't know if that, I honestly don't know if that's happened.
So tell me about when the Burgess Boys takes place. Pretty contemporary story?
It's a contemporary story, yeah. 2006. It's specifically set in 2006.
So with the Somali population mm-hmm. in Maine, has that changed much? I mean, has the thinking of the residents changed and the thinking of the Somali population changed?
It has certainly evolved over the last number of years, as things do. And there's been more acceptance of this. And the Somalis are great entrepreneurs, and they've set up some businesses. And Maine is in such dire straits. I mean, there's so much unemployment. I just came from Minneapolis, which has the highest Somali population in the country. And that was wonderful. I went and met with many members of the Somali community. And that's a different thing altogether, because the rate of unemployment is not as high. And so it's much more conducive for them to be able to get a bit of a foothold in our culture. But Maine is still, it's not even so much the racial aspects and the religious aspects, which are very prominent, but just the fact that there's no jobs for anyone. And that throws in a whole nother monkey wrench, as we say.
Tell me a little bit about the book, Olive Kitteridge.
Well, it's about this woman whose name is Olive, and she's from Maine. It's a book that's written as a series of short stories, and they're all connected, so that when you read the book from beginning to end, I think there's the sense that you've read a novel, but each chapter stands on its own as a story, and somehow I wanted to do that. It felt like that was the best way to write it, because Olive she's quite a force, and she's quite strong-minded and quite unpleasant at times, and then quite surprisingly tender-hearted at times. So you're in for a bit of a ride with Olive Kitteridge. So I wanted some of the chapters in between to focus on other people in the community, partly to give the reader a rest from this woman, and also because I love point of view, and I think she's in all the stories, but I think it's fun to see her from an entirely different point of view, because that's how we live. We think, oh, there's our neighbor across the street, I know her, but we only know her sometimes as the neighbor across the street. So some people just know Olive as this particular person. So that was fun for me to turn her around and see her from different angles.
So the short story here might be looking at the neighbor, one short
That's
story
right.
with
That's
the neighbor,
right.
maybe next her job mm-hmm. or maybe a travel or something like
yep.
that. And they're each
right.
one in their own whole stories.
Right.
With a short story, is that more or less difficult for you or for an author to write as opposed to a full-length novel?
Well, there are some authors who are just short story writers and then others who are just novelists. And somebody asked me the other day, well, you're mostly a novelist, right? And I thought, well, I guess, since I've written novels, but I do also write short stories. I mean, I've always loved writing short stories. So they're very different experiences in a certain way to write, because you have to get a lot more done more quickly, obviously, in a short story. But it's not quite the commitment, you know. I mean, when you're taking on a Somali community and three siblings and a tragic past and all this kind of stuff, I mean, that's like lifting a universe over your shoulders. And that's quite a commitment. Whereas a short story, I take it very seriously and I want to have it as good and real as it can be. But it's just obviously not going to be the same kind of, usually the same kind of endeavor. Although there was one story in Olive Kitteridge that took me about 10 years to write, but I was doing other things at the same time, obviously, so it wasn't like everything stopped.
So not quite the research that you did for that book and the short stories, I guess, as opposed to the Burgess Boys.
Right. There's one story in Olive Kitteridge where she and her husband are taken hostage in a hospital by people who have come in to rob the place of drugs. It's a small hospital, and they are taken hostage. And so I did actually do quite a bit of research about hostage situations, because I wanted to be accurate and I wanted to learn about that. So, you know, there are times that I have to make sure that I'm, you know, on point, but not like with the Burgess Boys, which was a larger thing altogether. Yeah.
So you went to maybe a SWAT team to ask questions, or where did you get them up with research?
Wouldn't that have been fun? If I could have found a SWAT team, I would have. But I didn't really know how to find a SWAT team, so I just
call up and say I have a gun. I'm holed up in the house
with my very first novel, Amy and Isabel. There's just a bit of a scene where the young person Amy does discover this dead body in the back of a trunk of a car. And I thought, well, I need to know what she sees, even though it's just, you know, half a paragraph. And I called the medical examiner in New York and I said, I'm sorry, I'm a writer. Could you tell me if this body, you know, and she was wonderful. She goes, yeah, I can. This is what it was, you know, and it was, and I thought, isn't that nice? You just ask and you find out. But no SWAT team. It didn't occur to me to call a SWAT team.
Well, the Burgess Boys, talking about the Somali people coming in to Maine and doing the research, who did you get to do the research with? Who did you ask?
Well, for the first number of years, I just read everything so that I would have a foundation. And then I know some people in Lewiston who have worked with the Somali community. And because they knew me and knew that I wouldn't be, or felt, you know, trusted me that I wouldn't just be taking advantage of this very vulnerable population, I was able to make my way into, you know, some homes and talk with people and be present at the food pantry where you learn a lot. And then there were Somali people in New York that I would meet with that would sometimes be, you know, at the African Center or whatever. So I made my way very gradually.
What are the differences between the Somalis in maybe a smaller town like you write about in Maine and the people in a bigger town like New York?
In the Somali community in New York is much more sporadic. There's just little pockets of, and so I don't think they have a chance. You know, they're very community oriented. They're much more, I think, in some ways community oriented than the American culture, which is very, you know, we're all about the individual. That's how we, you know, that's our history as a country. Like, you know, we, you know, the individual and the individual rights. And that's not so true. They're much more family community oriented and tend to move as community, or, and so in New York, I think that has not been as easy, and that's why they have moved to places like Lewiston, Maine, or Seattle, or Minneapolis.
Sounds like they came here, according to your book, the Burgess Boys. I mean, it sounds just like an awful life where they were.
Terrible. What they have gone through has been unspeakable. Unspeakable what they've gone through. Their country's civil war, what they have seen, what they ran from, had to run from to save their lives and their children's lives, and then to live for years, many of them, in these refugee camps in Kenya, just beyond, I think, many people's imaginations.
Well, they come here, but I think sometimes they think as the people of the United States as devils. Is that changing, I guess, with the people when they're
I don't
here?
Think that they think of the people in the United States as devils.
Maybe
that's not been my experience.
Yeah, but maybe they think the way that we live, probably a little too loose, maybe?
That really was not my experience. I think that there's a consumerism that is confusing to them. They, you know, they don't necessarily understand why we need all the things that we seem to think that we need. But certainly the people that I have met have been very glad to be here. They have suffered abuse, of course, because we, many Americans, aren't used to them and unfortunately have not always been kind, and that's just the way human nature is. But I think that I was talking to a Somali man yesterday who had gone back to Somalia, and it was just so tragic for him to see everything. And he came back through immigration, and he knew that he was probably going to have trouble. And the immigration fellow said to him, "So you've come back from Somalia?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, welcome home." And I thought it was the loveliest thing, and this man was just so moved. And so this is his home. And we, as the great country that we are, we have invited them here, as we have invited people for years to come here because they are in desperate straits.
Well, I guess I get that from a little part in your book here about one of the Somali protagonists who sent his wife here.
Mm-hmm.
And she decided that she really didn't want him. But I think he had like four wives where mm-hmm. he came from, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But he thought maybe the United States or the people turned her that, you know, they taught her to be more independent, I guess.
Right. Well, again, that's partly his age. He's an older man, and so has a different point of view from probably a younger man who's come from Somalia or has been in this country for a longer time. But yes, I mean, traditionally, he would have expected his wife to be more interested in him. But the other Somali woman thinks, well, I don't think it's America. I think she's just born that way, and she was never going to be a good wife to him anyway. So,
I was asking a little earlier about how you write your books, maybe like the Burgess Boys. Now, with the town, with the people that you have in it, do you have maybe a manuscript or a map that maybe refreshes your memory about who you have or where you're at?
There are times, boy, that I've had to pin things around the wall and just try and keep it all straight. That's a real problem, writing a book like this, because there's so much information. I have to pare it down to, 300 pages? And I'm not exactly sure how that's done. You know, finally, at some point, I say, okay, now, come on, let's just start at the beginning. You know, I try and think, what does the reader need? I mean, I have much more information than the reader needs. So let me try and imagine what it's like to be the reader and give them only what they need to get the essence of the story.
And that's going to be hard for maybe an author to do. Sometimes the information is just so overwhelming for the reader. And with the Burgess Boys, I thought it was a great balance.
I believe very much in writing for a reader. I have an ideal reader in mind, somebody who's patient but not too patient, and somebody who needs the book, you know, the way sometimes we find we need a book that we didn't know we needed, but somebody who's going to hold me to the line and not give me a whole lot of leeway. And so I keep that reader in mind, because we've all read books where we think, well, okay, where is this going? And I don't want that to go on for too long.
I suppose most people talk about the Pulitzer Prize right off the, you know, right in the beginning. I saved it here towards the end.
Quite all right.
Tell me about that. What did you win the prize for, and how was the process? How did you find this out and everything?
I won the prize for Olive Kittredge, and I was very surprised. It turns out that apparently a lot of writers know the day that the Pulitzer Prize is going to be announced, and I'm not one of them. I was not one of them. And I was actually in Las Vegas about to catch a train. I was on a tour, a lecture tour, and I was about to catch a plane, and I had turned my phone off because I had given a talk. And in the ride on the way back, I was chatting with a nice man that was giving me the ride, and I saw that I had many messages on my phone. But I thought, well, it's rude to just say, you know, I've got to check these messages. So then his phone rang. And it was my agent had tracked him down, because, you know, it was 3 hours earlier in New York time. They were furious. And my agent said, where have you been? You've won the Pulitzer Prize. We haven't been able to get. And I was like, I did? I won the Pulitzer Prize? It was just so fun. It was really nice.
So was there a short list that you knew you were on?
No,
or
I had
just
a clue.
By surprise?
Wow. I had no clue. I had absolutely no idea.
That's pretty cool.
It was cool.
So what's next?
Well, I'm writing something, and I'm not sure what it is. It's fiction, but I don't know beyond that exactly.
Was the Burgess Boys the same way when you wrote it? You didn't know what you were going to write, or
I knew it was a novel. I mean, I knew that it was not going to be written like Olive Kittredge. With Olive Kittredge, I knew right away I'm going to do this as stories together. And I knew with the Burgess Boys, this will be a novel. This will be a more traditional kind of novel from beginning to end. That's about all I knew.
You just start putting...
I just start making a big mess.
Words
big,
to paper,
mess.
And it just flows.
Eventually, 7 years later, it rises.
Wow. Put a little yeast in the flour, it'll be the same,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. You can't force it. I've learned that about myself. I just show up every day, you know, like anybody does at their job. You just show up. You show up.
Do you have a website we could
visit? I do have a website, elizabethstrout.com.
.com. When we go there, what are we going to see?
I hope you see what you think is a lovely design. I had a wonderful web designer that I think put together just a very nice, clean, nice-looking website. And you'll find whatever you want, I think. You'll find interviews. You'll find reviews. But it's laid out. I hope you'll find quite or the listener will find that it's laid out in a very accessible way and very calm way.
Find out where you'll be, what lectures you're doing, everything.
All that, yeah.
All right, so be sure to check that out, ElizabethStrout.com.
That's right.
All right. Well, this is the end of the show. The book is The Burgess Boys by Elizabeth Strout. You know, this book, it's going to take you right into the story very quickly, and you're going to enjoy the ride. Elizabeth Strout, a great storyteller. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. It's been wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
Been listening to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Elizabeth Strout, author of her brand new book in softcover, The Burgess Boys.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.